Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. I'm Rob Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today we are going to be talking about the ultimate classic of modern B-movies, Troll 2. This has got to be the one, right? Like, even if you rarely watch B-movies, you might have seen this one.
Yeah, this is one of the titans of bad film, of B-films. And it's one where, on one hand, some listeners might say, hey, this is only the second episode of Weird House Cinema. I can't believe you're doing Troll 2 already. But really, the reality is we had to go ahead and do Troll 2. Otherwise, listeners would be asking for it. They would be demanding it. And we have, this is just the hospitable thing to do. And we don't piss on hospitality on this show. I do want to add a quick note. Some of you are probably listening to this and you're like, what is Weird House Cinema? What is going on? This is a science and culture podcast. Why are you talking about B-movies and weird films? Well, this is something we're trying. This is something we just kicked off. Joe and I have been talking about doing a weird movie standalone podcast for a while. We were looking at other options, and it was decided, partially by us, partially by Powers on High, that we would do this as a little extra episode that airs on Fridays. I don't think they're going to let us publish it at midnight because I don't think that would be good business, but you can think of it as the midnight offering from Stuff to Blow Your Mind.
Right. The principalities and powers decree it must come out in the daytime, but you can still enjoy it in the daytime. Watch the movie at night and then listen in the day.
Yeah. Or you can skip it. If weird films aren't your thing, just skip it. And you can watch our core episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, which are still going to come out Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Now, I think it's good to get into Troll 2 early in the lifetime of this series because Troll 2 is a nuclear weapon of thematic heft. It brings all of the themes, mainly meat and vegetables are the themes of Troll 2. In fact, just before we started recording, we were talking about that obnoxious mid-2010s bacon craze where suddenly there was just ironic bacon on everything. You know, there would be like there's a website called The Art of the Mustache that has a logo with a guy in a top hat and a monocle, and they sell bacon-flavored whiskey. And I don't know where all that came from, but I strongly suspect the pork industry.
Yeah. And one place that it did not take root, though, is definitely the town of Nilbog. Nilbog is the setting for the movie Troll 2. And this is where the goblins live. Nilbog, of course, is goblin spelled backwards. This is a strange town somewhere in America. We get kind of a Utah feel.
It's Utah.
From this. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's here that we find an American family on vacation running afoul of goblins and an ancient witch who uses Stonehenge magic in order to turn people into like vegetable goo so that vegetarian goblins can eat them.
Yes, I would say that is the plot in a nutshell. It's that there are vegetarian goblins who eat people, but they have to turn them from meat into vegetarian green jello before they can eat them. And they worship Stonehenge.
Well, you know, let's just go ahead and listen to a little bit of the audio from the original trailer.
You're late.
I'm sorry we had a small mishap.
Here are the keys.
Here are ours.
Have a nice stay in Nilbog.
You in our city.
Still telling the same story, Josh?
Goblins don't exist. Goblins don't exist.
And remember,
they're eating her. They're going to eat me.
Kids with a sweet tooth like yours love ice cream.
Delicious and purified.
So this is, you know, we're talking about what makes a good weird film or a good bad film, et cetera, the kind of film we want to talk about on this show. And really, this does have everything. It has a weird plot. It has weird performances. It has like just weird choices in how they're going to try and tell this story. It just brings it all. And at the same time, it's an exceedingly watchable film. Like, there's never a dull moment in Troll 2.
It's impossible to be bored while watching Troll 2.
Yeah.
This is the kind of movie that also, it's not just entertaining, it sucks people in. It's like a magnet. If you put it on in a house and people are doing things in other rooms, the people will come from the other rooms to the Troll 2. They come from all over to kneel at the foot of Stonehenge. And it's also got a kind of cultural sensibility that exists basically nowhere else, because it's part very much Italianissimo bad horror. You know, it's very Italian, but it's also very Utah. And so we were calling it last night Utalian.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it, because the filmmakers themselves, most of the crew were Italian. Then the actors are all American, and a lot of them like just very local, non-actor American.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this film came out in 1990, so I want to set the stage a little bit here. You don't really need to understand like what was going on politically or culturally in the world, for the most part, to understand Troll 2. But Troll 2 is definitely what I refer to as a gremlin film, okay? So it's one of the many, many films about small, mischievous monsters to come out in the wake of 1984's Gremlins.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you ever walked around a video rental store, you know what I'm talking about. Because we didn't just have Gremlins and then eventually Gremlins 2. You had Ghoulies. You had Critters. You had Hobgoblins. You had Munchies. And you had these troll films.
I didn't know about Munchies. I had to look it up. It looks gross. It looks just nasty.
So Troll 2 is marketed as a sequel to the gremlin film Troll, which came out in 1986, which has nothing to do with Troll 2. Troll was a Charles Band production. And, of course, Charles Band is a notable maker of weird films. I think we'll definitely come back to Charles Band on these episodes in the future.
I think he made the Puppet Master movies, didn't he?
He did. One thing with Charles Band to keep in mind, without
Small Creatures.
He does like Small Creatures, but he was more serious early on in his career, and I think he kind of found a niche later on as making sort of intentionally bad films to a certain extent. You know, once you get into like Evil Bong and the Gingerbread film, what was it, Ginger Dead? I can't remember offhand.
The Ginger Dead Man, that was him.
He did some sort of Gingerbread Man,
okay,
the evil creature thing. Yeah, but before that was Puppet Masters, and then before even that were some films that I hope we'll get back to on this show. But Troll from 1986 was definitely an attempt to cash in on the Gremlin craze. It starred the wonderful Michael Moriarty as Harry Potter Senior. Yes, firmly establishing Harry Potter as a fictional character prior to the Harry Potter books. Atreyu himself, Noah Hathaway, was Harry Potter Jr. in that film. And you also had Julia Louis-Dreyfus and Sonny Bono showing up as various in various roles. But it was not... There's no connection here between Troll 1 and Troll 2. Troll 2 is an Italian production from Shockmaster Joe D'Amato. That's the producer.
And this is actually something that was pretty common for Italian films at the time. Like a lot of Italian horror movies would be marketed as a sequel to an existing movie, even though they had nothing to do with it whatsoever. So, for example, the Italian movie Zombie was marketed as a sequel to Dawn of the Dead, even though it was not made by George Romero, had nothing to do with Dawn of the Dead. It just wasn't related. And there are other movies by Claudio Fragasso, the director of Troll 2, that were marketed as movies in an existing franchise. So example, they were marketed as like a movie in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre franchise, even though they weren't.
Right. And in that case, the film in question being Nightkiller, so Texas Chainsaw Massacre had a different title in Italy, and then it's the sequel to that. So it's not instantly recognizable to a lot of Western film fans that this would be marketed as a sequel to Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah, in Italy, Texas Chainsaw was non aprite della puerta, I think, which means like do not open that door.
Ah, well, that's great. I love a good don't film.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, let's talk about some of the people of note here. So really, one of the main two people to focus on is the director himself, Claudio Fragasso, born in 1951, still very much alive as of this recording, and still making films, I believe. While Troll 2 is probably his most well-known film in the U.S., he's had quite a long career in the Italian film world, with some of his pictures shooting in the United States. He has 30 director credits, 40 screenwriting credits, including such notable entries as Monster Dog, starring Alice Cooper, and then Shocking Dark, which is a Bruno Mattei-directed knockoff of Aliens and Terminator. And it's kind of infamous in its own right for being just a blatant knockoff.
Mm-hmm. Well, mainly, from what I understand, I haven't seen that one, the box art is just the cover of Terminator. I mean, it's just straight up James Cameron's Terminator, a traced version of it pretty much. But the movie is more a ripoff of Aliens, isn't it?
Yeah. Like I was watching some clips from it, and it's clearly like, let's go make Aliens, guys. Let's do it.
Mm-hmm.
But with a much cheaper budget, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Aliens was a prolifically ripped off film.
Yes.
Like Aliens has more copycats than maybe any other movie I can think of. It really spawned the space marine genre, which was everywhere in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah. I mean, it's been ripped off at every level, too. It's been ripped off at the Shocking Dark level, but also just so many films would not exist. Like they're clearly, feeding on that same energy. They're tapping into that same vein.
Mm-hmm. But now, so a lot of the directors, writer directors, auteurs who create horror movies, you might be tempted to kind of just call them hacks. Like they're just phoning in some work, they're pointing the camera at things, they're telling the actors what to say, and then they get on with it. I get the feeling from at least Troll 2 that Fragasso very much sees himself as an artist, and he is in there in the movie.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So, for instance, two of the names I already mentioned, Joe D'Amato and Bruno Mattei. So Joe D'Amato, I really have enjoyed some of his films, but he was very much a in the business of titillation. Like, mm-hmm. what can I do violently or erotically on the screen that will bring viewers in? And then Bruno, and Fragasso points this out as well in interviews, like Bruno was very much like, let's make some money. Let's go do a Predator movie.
Right.
I'm going to make Aliens. Write me a script for Aliens. We'll call it Shocking Dark. You know, like that was very much the vibe. But Fragasso, I think one of the things that's fascinating about him is that he did seem to think of himself as this like legitimate auteur, you know, that he had something to say in these films. And that can be vital to having like a really, you know, successful weird film or just a really amusing B film because somebody cares. Mm-hmm. I think we've pointed this out before, to really enjoy any film, but especially a B movie, somebody has to be serious about it. There's got to be an actor in there mm-hmm. or an FX person, a cinematographer. Somebody's got to be serious about saying something with this film.
With Troll 2, you really get the feeling that Fragasso, this is not just a plot device. He really means it when he says that evil can only be defeated by the power of goodness and by processed meat. Like, yes. He really thinks that.
Yeah, because we do have to drive home that just because you have ideas and just because you have something you want to say, it doesn't mean you're capable of creating interesting cinema. It doesn't mean you're capable of actually pushing those ideas through to the finished product. It doesn't mean that those ideas are going to survive the budgetary constraints or your limited ability to cast professional actors in the role, etc. But still, you can often see that the effort is there in the finished product. Like at some point, somebody cared. And I should point out that Fragasso seems pretty open about this in recent interviews I've seen with him, where he's like, "Yeah, I really thought I was, as a serious filmmaker when I was making Troll 2 or Night Killer or whatever the case may be." And I think he kind of like sees like, "Oh yeah, maybe I should have listened a little more to Bruno when he was telling me, no, you're making a horror movie, you're making a slasher movie, you're making a monster movie, just go out and make it." But you know, he wanted to inject this art or this commentary on what he was doing.
You get a sense of artistic ego also in his work, in mm-hmm. the very best classical sense, like a John Milton kind of ego, the person who believes that that his message is very important and he's the only one who can say it.
Yeah. Now, of course, these are not these films are not just Fragasso's voice. Also, there's the voice of his co-screenwriter and I believe partner, Rossella Drudi. Now, Drudi was born in 1963, frequent collaborator with her husband, and seemed to share his ambition for exploring social commentary and psychology in their films. As John O'Brien pointed out in a recent piece for Sci-Fi Wire, she described Troll 2 as a, quote, ferocious analysis of today's society.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely about today's society where you... Where you can't get any eggs at the store because the guy there says blah, and he only gives you unrefrigerated milk.
Yeah, just sitting there on the shelf, that Nilbog milk.
It's definitely about today's society where when you move into a new neighborhood, they bring you a cheesecake, but it's made with wild nettles that turn your body into green jello. It points out how in society today, you can take a month off of work by just calling your boss the night before and saying, "Hey, I'm going to be gone for a month. Can you take care of that business for me?"
Yeah. So basically, Troll 2 is just wall-to-wall, wonderful little dialogue exchanges between characters who are supposed to be human, or at least in the case of the Nilbogians, they're supposed to be goblins pretending to be humans. Mm-hmm. Everybody says things that no human has ever said, that no human would ever say, things that just don't sound like authentic human dialogue. It seems as if the entire movie is actually populated by goblins trying to pass themselves off as human beings.
I want to come back to this point about the lack of verisimilitude later on, because I think that is the defining aesthetic feature of the movie, and we should explore that in a bit.
Yes. Let's go ahead and go through the rest of the cast for what it's worth here. We have to mention Michael Paul Stevenson, who plays the boy, Joshua Waits. Notably, but mostly in terms of Troll 2, for making the 2009 documentary Best Worst Movie, which is an exploration of what this film is and where it came from. But he's also directed other things. He directed the 2017 Bob Odenkirk movie Girlfriend's Day.
I saw Best Worst Movie at a screening here in Atlanta at a local theater, and George Hardy, the actor who plays the father in the family in Troll 2, mm-hmm. was there to answer questions at the screening. It was really special.
The dentist with the linebacker's jaw that plays the dad, yeah.
Yes. Well, I think, so here's another thing about Troll 2, and we should describe the plot in more detail in a minute here, but it is about a family who goes to this goblin-infested town. The family, I think, is clearly supposed to be modeled on the family from Poltergeist, because we just recently watched Poltergeist, and I would be shocked if in casting George Hardy, they weren't trying to go for Craig T. Nelson.
Yeah, he is kind of like a bottom basement Craig T. Nelson. Yeah.
Yeah.
And definitely he's great in it as well. But a couple of the real standout performances for me are from other characters. For instance, there's an actor by the name of Deborah Reed who plays the witch, Credence Lenore Gilgood, in this particular movie. And this is pretty much her only acting role, but she just acts her heart and face off in every scene. Like, you get the impression that Fragasso was just saying, like, I like what you're doing, but go ahead and do it like 50 times what you're doing now. Just more. Just give me more of that.
Uh-huh. He's like George Lucas, faster, louder, more intense.
Yes.
But she takes it to heart. Credence slays in this movie. She is so good. She is it's a very melodramatic community theater type performance, but she's the kind of actor who you would see in an amateur community theater production, but she would be the standout actor, head and shoulders above everybody else in that. Like, you wouldn't be able to stop talking about her after it was over.
I would say that it is perhaps one of the most memorable overacting jobs of all time.
Yeah.
And it's almost not overacting because it fits in this film perfectly. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like everybody else is doing like a real refined and professional time and she's just hamming it up. No, I mean, this is the perfect place for this level of hamminess.
Uh-huh. Now, what about, I know you wanted to talk about the guy who runs the general store in Nilbog, the guy who's like, we don't have any bacon or eggs here. Blah, that's, the guy.
Coffee.
It's the devil's drink, but we do have shelves and shelves of unrefrigerated milk and what looks like jars of pink teeth is all I could say. I'm not sure what that's supposed to be.
Yeah, they didn't get to that one. Maybe there's a cutscene. But no, this guy playing the drugstore owner is Don Packard. Mm-hmm. This is his only screen role outside of, showing up in the documentary. But man, he comes off as a legitimately creepy and intense character in a way that really makes me think this guy missed his calling as a B-movie heavy. Because
yeah.
He has this kind of like carved from granite face. He looks like he should be like just an old cowboy sitting in the back of a Gunsmoke episode.
Yeah, he could have been a Michael Ironside of his generation, but not quite.
Oh, instead, he's his generation's Don Packard. But, it's a memorable performance. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A lot of the other actors in the film were, of course, just straight up locals, and many of them didn't work beyond this picture. But there is an interesting person from the crew, Laura Gemser, an actor who starred in numerous Emmanuel movies, which were erotic pictures of the day. Sometimes she was credited as Emmanuel, or she'd be playing the Emmanuel character. She was the costume designer on Troll 2, and reportedly she was the only crew member who spoke both Italian and English well enough to communicate with the actors. So she was the communicative bridge between the filmmakers and the crew and the cast.
She was the human babblefish that made this artistic production possible.
Yes.
Well, that makes sense because a lot of the dialogue in this movie feels like when you take a sentence and you run it through Google Translate several times to different languages.
Yeah. And apparently Fragasso was very... was very firm on the idea that the script should be used verbatim. So there was going to be no ad-libbing, no taking the dialogue and putting it in a form that would come out naturally through your mouth. No, it needed to stay in the original form, and therefore you have these just strangely structured sentences and sometimes just strangely expressed thoughts.
Well, maybe we should run through the plot a little bit just to say what happens in the film point by point.
Okay.
So one of the the movie starts with an apparent fairy tale scene. You've got a guy who looks like Jack and the Beanstalk. He's got on the elf hat, and he's wandering through the forest, and he comes across a girl who offers him some green goo. I guess it looks like toothpaste, kind of like AIM brand or whatever it is that has that really verdant green.
It's so green that it looks like virtually nothing you would consume. It's like too green to be bad absinthe, toothpaste, or candy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. She offers this to him. And then we realize that this is a story being told to a child by an old man. And yes. The old man is Grandpa Seth, and the child is Joshua, the main kid in the movie. And as Grandpa Seth narrates the story, I would love to see what book he was reading out of, because he talks about, like, when this girl kneels down to feed Jack the goo, he says that she was a lovely girl with huge eyes the color of the sea, which brought to mind like Homeric scholarship questions about like, what color is the sea? What does the wine dark sea mean? I'm not sure what that was supposed to mean there, but she has lots of freckles drawn onto her face with a Sharpie. They just took a marker and dotted her cheeks. And then she feeds him the stuff, and he starts bleeding green all over the place. And then the goblins eat him. And then the end of Grandpa's story is just like, yes, they ate him. That's just what happened. And that's there's no happiness or redemption at all. It's just a fairy tale where the guy gets eaten and that's it.
But it's pretty great because we've introduced the magic, we've introduced the monsters, and introduced the rules for how they function. You know, they don't eat meat, they eat vegetables, but they use magic to turn people into vegetables so that they can eat them.
Right. I think that's all pretty well established early on, but I just have to say a couple of other things about this opening scene. So one thing we find out is that Grandpa Seth, who's telling the story to Joshua, he's a ghost, and he vanishes yes. as soon as the mom appears in the room. And it becomes clear that Joshua has been repeatedly hallucinating his dead grandfather, and he's not supposed to be hallucinating him anymore. The parents are like, you've got to stop. And she says to him, I think the line is, Grandpa Seth is in all our hearts, but you must banish him from your mind. like send him to the realm of dust and ghosts.
I love this because this is a case where someone could have made a firm case to Fragasso and said, look, you got two movies here. Why don't you do the dead grandpa ghost movie and maybe they can fight, killer rednecks or something. Mm-hmm. But then you've got this supernatural troll thing. That's another movie. But Fragasso's like, no, this is one movie. We're going to do both of these crazy elements in one film.
One of the things I love, I mean, the movie fails at verisimilitude at essentially every level, but I love Joshua's bedroom because I noticed for the first time watching it this time, actually, I can't remember if I've said this already, but this is a movie I watched probably 50 times when I was in college and then didn't watch for about a decade. And so coming back to it was like one of those dreams where you wander through your childhood home going from room to room, and it's been a long time, but it's very familiar. But you also notice things anew. And one of the things I noticed this time was that in Joshua's bedroom, he has merch from essentially every baseball team. I'm not a real sports fan, but I thought usually you would have your team or your couple of teams, and they're the ones you're fans of, and you've got their kind of stuff. But Joshua apparently has like flags and merch for his 17 top baseball teams.
This one kind of feels like a case where you have filmmakers who know what it's like to be a movie fan, maybe don't know what it's like to be, especially an American sports fan, and you just kind of roughly translate one into the other, you know? Mm-hmm. Like if I were trying to figure out as a teenager, like what it's like to be a fan of sports, so I'd be like, oh, well, I guess you just get a bunch of posters. Like in everywhere in my room that I have a music or a movie poster, I would just replace that with some sort of sport poster.
Yeah, it's possible I'm just wrong about this. Sports fans, let us know. I mean, do you have merch for your 20th favorite baseball team? I'd be curious. But what we find out is the family is about to go on vacation for a month to this town called Nilbog to trade houses with some people from the town. They're going to come stay in their house. And they're just telling everybody the night before they leave that they're going to be gone for a month. So the dad appears to be on the phone with his boss or his workplace or something. He's like, yeah, we'll be gone for a month. Yeah, it's called Nilbog. Can you take care of that for me? The daughter, Holly, is telling her boyfriend that night that she's about to be gone for a month. And it's like one of the many ways in which there's lack of verisimilitude in this movie is that the characters are as if they just started existing when the movie began, and there's no attempt to create a through line that, like, they had lives before the camera started rolling.
I will say that the basic plot here, the whole switching houses for a month thing, it almost makes more sense in 2020 than it could have possibly made sense in 1990.
Right.
You know, like, if you had a coworker today and they were going to be like, oh, yeah, I'm going to be switching houses with some friends for a month.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, just there'll be a different background on my Zoom call. You'd be like, all right, that makes sense. That makes as much sense as anything this year.
Right, right. Yeah. If you're a digital worker, I don't think George Hardy in this movie is supposed to be a digital worker. I mean, for all I know, he's supposed to be a dentist like the actor actually was. but yeah, so they travel to this country. And again, the family is very much the family from Poltergeist. Craig T. Nelson, the kids are kind of fighting. They drive 10 miles per hour on the freeway. That's pretty fun. And Joshua keeps hallucinating encounters with Grandpa Seth, who's warning them not to go to Nilbog because he says it's a kingdom of evil where the goblins rule.
One of the great things about Grandpa throughout this film is that he has, and I have difficulty figuring out at times whether this was intentional. There's almost a Grandpa Simpson level of clumsiness to his ghostly presence, you know?
Yes, yes, very. Yeah, there's one part where he's trying to appear in a mirror like Bloody Mary to contact Joshua, but he gets the wrong room in the house and he accidentally appears in Holly's mirror and she screams and freaks out. Like 5 minutes of the film are devoted to this mix up. They're really kind of padding it out there.
So I don't know if that's an inept choice or really a genius choice. I don't know. It works. Within the context of Troll 2, it absolutely works.
Yeah. So they get to the town, also arriving at the town, because I guess you've got to fill out the cast. This is a thing that often happens in horror movies. You'll notice that, you know, somewhere toward the middle of the first act, it starts getting populated with seemingly unimportant characters. And you're like, why are all these people suddenly appearing in the movie? It's because, well, this is a horror film and you need just randos to get murdered as the film progresses. Like, you've got to fill out the kill list, basically. And so that is mainly done in this movie by having Holly's boyfriend, Elliot, and his three weird friends show up in a camper van or an RV, I guess, and they're just hanging out in the town too. And so you know what's going to happen to these buddies here.
Yeah, they're just pure fodder.
But in all of the scenes where the goblins attack the humans, they all pretty much have the same progression, which is the human is given something to eat or drink, and then they eat or drink it, and that turns them into the green goop or turns them into a plant somehow, and then the goblins eat or otherwise attack them.
Yeah, so the main threat becomes this, and this is something that Joshua is woken up to before the rest of the family. You will be tricked into eating something at some point that will transform your entire family into vegetables, and then the trolls will eat them.
Right, and probably most famously, this is dealt with at a scene where the family arrives at the house where they're going to be staying for a month, and out on the table is laid a bountiful feast of disgusting-looking Play-Doh food that looks like it was made out of, like, mud and sticks by a child, and sometimes with toothpaste and green paint. And they're like, delicious! Look what they've prepared for us! And they all sit down to eat. And so Grandpa Seth says Joshua has to find a way to stop them from eating. And this is one of the most famous scenes in the movie. He says, you know, since I am Kronos, the Wizard of Time, I'm just going to stop time for 30 seconds to give you time to figure that out. But if Grandpa Seth has the power to stop time, you would think that would be useful throughout the movie. Instead, he only does it once.
What I kind of love about this is that it makes the audience think. Mm. It's kind of like a werewolf break.
Right.
Where
yes.
the director's saying, all right, audience, how would you stop your family from eating the tainted food?
Right. What would you do?
And of course, he does the most ridiculous thing possible. But in a way, this is like, again, the brilliance of this film, because only Fragasso would choose to have the child use this moment to jump up on the table and pee, urinate on all of the food, thus tainting it further and preventing the family from eating it.
We're thankfully spared seeing that actually happen. There's a cutaway, yeah, and then you see them scraping the food out, and the father...
It's a tasteful movie.
Yeah, it's quite tasteful. And the father is chewing Joshua out. He says, like, you can't piss on hospitality. I won't allow it.
Oh, yeah, and he shames them. He's like, he's messing with his belt after he takes him up, and he's like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm tightening my belt a notch because of the coming hunger pains.
So... One thing about this is I was like, I know there has got to be a good monster science tie-in, and I found one. Are you ready for some monster science?
Let's do it.
Okay, so surely there is evidence of some kind of animal, Joshua, that pees on food in order to get people not to eat it. And you know what? I didn't find exactly that, but I found something pretty close. I found a paper from the Canadian Journal of Zoology by Fred H. Harrington called Urine Marking at Food and Caches in Captive Coyotes. So the study was done in captive coyotes, Canis latrans, and as always, it's worth noting that animals sometimes behave differently in captivity than they do under natural conditions, so it's possible the behaviors described here wouldn't be as common in the wild. But either way, Harrington notes that often when captive coyotes are observed during feeding, they will just sometimes urinate on food. They'll just pee on food piles or on, quote, individual food items that had been carried and dropped some distance from the pile. And also sometimes when a food item was stolen from one coyote taken by another, sometimes the animal would pee on it. So why would you pee on food piles and food items? You might be assuming something. You might guess, well, okay, these are canines, basically sort of dogs. So you might assume they are making a claim of possession, right? This food is mine now. I'm going to pee on it so that you understand. But this does not appear to be the case. Harrington writes, quote, marking of food did not reserve it for the marking animal. Others usually ignored the urine mark and ate the item, which is kind of gross, but okay. So in that case, what purpose does it serve? Well, one observation was that this behavior of peeing on a food item specifically increased a lot during the breeding season. So it's possible it played some role in, quote, the expression of dominance in intrasexual rivalries. So like if there are rivalries between the males or between the females, they might be expressing dominance by peeing on their food. That sounds kind of weird, like if you were doing some kind of office politics thing and you just like peed on your TV dinner in front of the person you're trying to impress. But, you know, canines are different. But there's another kind of food peeing, and specifically this was the peeing that occurred at food caches, so places where food was hidden or stored. Quote, urine marking never occurred when food was cached and rarely occurred while the cache still contained food. However, once the cache was emptied, urine marking usually occurred. Thus, at caches, urine marking evidently serves as a bookkeeping role, indicating that the caches are no longer worth investigating, although food odors might still linger, which I thought was really interesting. So, like, you pee on a food storage site, apparently as a note to self and possibly as a note to others as well, nothing to eat here, move along.
Yeah, don't expend the energy of getting in here because it's all the food has been depleted.
Right. So, and the same patterns of urine marking at caches have been observed in wolves and red foxes as well. And it's been documented in previous studies that this actually increases foraging efficiency. The dogs and other canines waste less time foraging for food when they mark emptied caches. It prevents you from wasting time trying to dig up food, places where food had been buried before but isn't there anymore.
Huh.
So anyway, there's a kind of canine Joshua thing going on here, right? So if they had been coyotes, maybe he would have peed all over the table, and then the family just would have been like, huh, I guess there's no food here. Got to move on.
Yeah. And of course, there was apparently no other food in the house, because this is what you do when you go to like an Airbnb, right? Mm-hmm. You bring no food of your own and you immediately start eating whatever food was in the refrigerator when you got there.
Right.
Or on the table in the case of this film.
But it's all just chunky milk that's in the fridge like everywhere in town.
As long as we're talking monster science here, let's talk a bit about the monsters in this film, the goblins themselves.
Okay.
So these are clearly little people actors in a horrific mix of costumes. Some of the costumes are really almost kind of convincing, except maybe in the eyes. Others look a little more hastily thrown together. But all in all, I find that they are like equal parts terrifying, like legitimately terrifying, because you're seeing people in strange like fur costumes mm-hmm. running at you with spears. And then at the same time, they're just completely goofy. Like they're just completely like it looks like someone left an Ewok costume out in the rain for a month.
Yes. I would say that the monster costumes in this film are cheap and bad, but they're actually scary because they're so cheap and bad. They don't code as monsters. They code as like people in deranged costumes coming at you.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think it works. I don't know if it works in the way that the filmmakers intended, but there are plenty of scenes where they're like running down the hallways or, you know, running through the woods mm-hmm. or standing menacingly in the woods and it works. Now, the most notable thing about the monsters here is that they must transform their animal prey into vegetation in order to consume them. And, of course, they do this via potions and magic. Now, to a certain extent, this makes perfect sense because in our food chain, there are plants that gain energy from the sun and then animals that consume the converted energy in those plants. And then there are predators that consume those herbivores. So it's kind of an inverted treatment of how this works that we see in the town of Nilbog. For example, just one example to sort of put all this in context, consider what leafcutter ants do. They harvest leaf clippings, but they don't eat the leaf clippings. They use the leaf clippings to grow a specific ant-domesticated fungus that they use as their primary food source. It's not a magical transformation from one biological kingdom to another, but it is an energy transformation. So in a way, like that's what we're seeing happen here with the goblins. You know, they're like, oh, well, we don't eat the people. We turn the people into something we can eat. And that's a lot like what we see with the leafcutter ants, just without the magic.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, you're relying on the digestion and energy storage faculties of a different species to do some of your digesting externally for you when you're a leafcutter ant like that. Like if you were to just eat the plant matter directly, you wouldn't be able to get as much energy out of it as you can get by growing some fungus.
Now, I can't remember. Do we find out how they're making the tainted food in the Milbog milk? Like, is that goblin milk from goblin teats, or is that some sort of are they like getting the goblin drippings from the people that have been turned into green mush?
This is the real Nilbogology question, and I don't know the answer. I don't think they ever show that in the movie. I mean, you get the sense that it's all magic. And there's one thing that's cool about this movie that it has in common with Halloween 3 Season of the Witch.
Yes.
Both movies rely on the magic of the Stonehenge magic stone. So in Halloween 3 Season of the Witch, Dan O'Herlihy, the old man from RoboCop, steals one of the rocks, one of the blue stones from Stonehenge, and then turns that into magic microchips that turn your head into crickets. In this movie, Credence has part of Stonehenge in her house, and there's light and fog that comes out of it. It's never explained how she got this part of Stonehenge. It was just there. And that seems to be the source of her power, from what I can tell.
Yeah. I mean, maybe she used the stone. She traveled through the stone, through time, and there's an actual link between the world of the Outlander books and the world of Troll 2. I'm gonna have to explore that on my own time, I think. But I think there might be a connection.
Kilt Lifter 4, Return to Nilbog.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. This movie, like we said, it seems to have a message. It had some sort of intent anyway. And going by what the filmmakers have to say about it, a certain amount of the deep thinking here seems to have revolved around the idea of vegetarianism as something that, if not in itself bad, is thrust upon us, that it poses a danger or a threat to people. Because we find ourselves thrust into a story where the monsters are all vegetarians, and then the weird people in the weird town, are all also very much opposed to the consumption of dairy or meat and coffee for some reason.
Well, regarding the coffee, I think there is some pretty strong Latter-day Saint influence on this film, or at least presence within the film, in the cast. But I would say maybe you're selling short the critique of vegetarianism here. I think this presents vegetarianism as a satanic cult.
Yeah. Yeah. There are scenes in the film where it's a little more vague as to how we're supposed to take it. But there are plenty of scenes where Troll 2 is is pushing vegetarianism as being this like violent transformation into plant matter, that there's this communal cultish pressure to drink Nilbog milk, to, you know, change, become one of us. So, you know, in these places, the film certainly reeks of an entirely hyperbolic reaction to vegetarianism and veganism that I think most of us are somewhat familiar with. You know, the sort of fear that your uncle might spout about how the liberals are going to force everyone to become vegans and the government is going to take your steak night away from you.
They're going to take away,
that sort of thing.
Yeah, they'll take your hamburgers. And specifically, I would say that to the extent this movie has a message, it's trying to take away the implied moral authority of vegetarianism or veganism. It assumes that someone who just eats plants thinks that they're better than you and the movie is showing you that, no, actually, they're the real murderers.
Yeah, it's like eating plants is murder. Let me show you how it works. It involves magic and monsters. Now, I don't think we have time to really go into depth on this particular topic, but there are some very solid health and environmental arguments for at least cutting back on the consumption of meat and dairy without even getting into moral arguments. At the same time, one does have to realize that vegetarian and vegan food products are not necessarily flawless choices. For example, just as far as milk substitutes go, you have to take into account the water usage and the crop location. As such, there are strong arguments for, say, oat milk as being a better choice than, say, almond milk, and a lot of that has to do with how much water is consumed. You also have to take into account like deforestation, habitat loss whenever you're talking about crops being grown. But this is, of course, also the case with dairy cows. For cow milk, you have to take into account the land use, the water use, and methane emissions from the cows themselves. It takes roughly 4 square kilometers of land to produce just one glass of cow's milk. And that, again, that land use means potential deforestation and habitat loss. And on top of that, the cows are probably eating soy or oats as well, which puts an additional land strain on their milk. Less land use is required, meanwhile, to produce milk from the same soy and oats for a plant-based milk. Each glass of dairy milk contributes half a kilogram of greenhouse gas emissions, and that's compared to 0.1 to 0.2 kilograms with plant-based milks. Now, I was looking over all these stats, and then I started thinking, well, what about Nilbog milk? We have no idea how to crunch the numbers on how environmentally sound Nilbog milk is.
There are scientists on both sides.
But anyway, back to the idea of you know, this film basically being about hating on vegetarians or vegans. I decided to look into it just a little bit, and I found a wonderful article on The Conversation from 2018 by Kate Stewart and Matthew Cole, titled "Vegans: Why They Inspire Fear and Loathing Among Meat Eaters." And this is an informative read. I recommend it to everybody. But here are just some of the highlights. So first, they point out that this has been going on for a while, but that a lot of the old stereotypes about vegans are not applicable anymore because it's simply more widespread. So all of these, quote, angry, militant, self-denying, sentimental, fatty, or joyless, unquote, stereotypes, they don't really zing like they used to. And I feel like you get a sense of that when you watch older television. If you find like a nice vegan or vegetarian jab on, say, an old episode of The Simpsons or even Futurama, you're like, oh, well, that doesn't really feel as authentic today as maybe it arguably was, 20 years ago.
Was The Simpsons jabbing at vegetarians? I remembered Lisa becoming one.
She did, but, well, I guess I mainly there's a Futurama episode where there's an annoying vegan character that shows up, and he's the one I mostly think of because it is like just an outrageous stereotype of like an angry vegan who wants to, wants to convert everyone around him. Mm-hmm. And of course they have him eaten by a lion at the end. Like there's some sort of perverse joy in seeing the vegan consumed by the animal.
Well, of course, I mean, a vegan vegetarian can be annoying just like anybody can be annoying.
Well, yes.
You know, yeah, everybody should be eaten by lions is what I'm really saying. But I think it's a pretty common feature of human psychology that people who abstain from what's perceived as hedonic activity are often vilified and disdained by the people who engage in that same activity. And this is true for not just meat. It's true for like everything that's perceived as like some kind of pleasurable consumption or activity, like drugs, alcohol, sex, unhealthy food, trashy TV. with any of that stuff, if you encounter somebody who says "none for me, thanks," it can kind of trigger a discomfort and defensiveness in the people who are having some of whatever it is, because, like, if you think of the scene at a party, you know, whether it's an episode of Mad Men or, you know, kids at college or whatever, if somebody tries to refuse a drink, that's not usually, people don't usually react to that in just a neutral way. Like if they had turned down a glass of water, you react like, "Oh, come on, have one." Or you say like, "Oh, now the vibe is off. You made it weird." Like there's a discomfort people have when others in their social circle are not engaging in all of the same hedonic activities that they are. And naturally, I think this comes from a place of insecurity. Like, the presence of a person who abstains from something is a natural social signal that makes you wonder if maybe you should be abstaining as well. And then it kind of makes you feel bad and makes you feel like, well, I'm thinking about consuming this more than I wanted to be thinking about it in this moment. And so the reaction is hostility and sometimes attempts at ostracism, like, "Oh, you think you're just so perfect, don't you?"
Yeah, and I guess a lot of this is unavoidable just by the fact that we are social animals and we pick up on all these cues. And this paper really backs up most of what you just said here. They, for instance, they point out, quote, "The exchange is arguably emblematic of the contemporary plague of entitled anger that toxifies public discourse whenever entitlement is challenged, however politely." So some of the other key points they make, they say part of this does seem to be unresolved guilt, as vegan lifestyles may be seen as implying a failure to act on a moral issue. Again, "Oh, you think you're so great. What? Oh, you're turning down meat. You're saying I should turn it down too, that I should feel guilty about eating this meat, etc." On top of that, it can be interpreted as an affront to freedom of choice for some weird reason, even though they are actually engaging in choice. It's not a choice if everybody has to eat steak, right? And then on top of that, quote, "Food practices are socially powerful markers of social and cultural identity, making actual or implied criticism of them personally and hurtfully felt." For instance, they give the example that meat often, this is less more social than cultural, I guess, but about how meat eating is often linked to masculine identity. and therefore, it could be seen as a threat to one's masculinity or some other, you know, way of some other like cultural critique. They're turning down meat. Meat is important to me. Therefore, they're turning down me.
I mean, it's weird that I know exactly what you're saying here, and I agree that there can be this feeling that your freedom is being challenged even when somebody has not told you not to do something. And not, I mean, right, let alone that they don't have any power to prevent you from doing it, but haven't even told you not to do it or suggested you shouldn't do it. And I think it's because sometimes when you do something without thinking about doing it, even being asked to think about the fact that you're doing it is perceived as a challenge to your freedom to do it. And I think that's where the abstinence of someone else comes in. Like, even if someone else abstains from whatever it is, meat or alcohol or whatever, even if they're not commenting on your behavior, the fact that you notice them abstaining makes you think about what you're doing when you weren't thinking about it before, and it doesn't feel good to do that.
Yeah. It's like, "Oh, I'm eating meat. Okay, I guess I'm a monster. I guess I'm a literal monster that catches tourists and eats them with magic." And so you want to turn that on its head and you want to create a scenario, right, in which the opposite is true.
Yeah, no, you're the monster. You're the one who's turning people into jello.
Yeah. So it's one of those things where with Troll 2, it is, on one hand, it's ridiculous. This seems like just a ridiculous hyperbolic thrust of your artistic expression. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, like, this is clearly, like, this is a real cultural energy. Like, this is a thing that people feel, even if they're not, like, truly rationalizing the thoughts. It's more, maybe it's more subconscious in many cases, but, you know, this is a true human reaction. So in a way, they've kind of pushed through that, and they've dared to make the film that makes these accusations.
Yeah, and then we should say, in the end, the way that they defeat the witch and the goblin is by eating a double-decker bologna sandwich while putting a hand on the Stonehenge magic stone.
Yeah, which is, within the context of the film, perfect. Just a perfect narrative choice. But it also just, again, reeks of this whole, like, oh, eating steak is bad. Watch me eat some steak. Oh, I'm going to eat steak so hard.
Uh-huh. It's like the sword and the stone, but with instead of a sword, it's like, you know, emulsified meat product.
Yeah. Well, that I mean, it would be the ultimate, you know, just straight up bologna.
Yes, it is funny that bologna is sort of used as the ultimate meat. It's not just any meat. It's like the meatiest meat you could have. And I think maybe that's because it is the most processed form of meat. Like, it is ground to a finer consistency than any other meat on earth. And thus, it's the most meaty. Like, it's inherently identifying the consumption of meat with industrial processes for production of food.
Yeah, it is like the ultimate, like, anti-druidic food product. Right. It's like the perfect thing to overturn Stonehenge with.
To hell with nature. Food should not look like the shape it originally inhabits. But there's one last thing I wanted to talk about before we wrap up our discussion of Troll 2, which is the idea of verisimilitude in film. This has come up a couple of times already. But one of the things everybody notices about Troll 2, probably its most salient aesthetic feature, is the overwhelming anti-verisimilitude in the dialogue. Almost every time a character says a line, your brain just raises a flag that says, not how people talk. And so I'm trying to think of the best examples. One is when Joshua says to his dad, while they're standing there being observed by a bunch of the creepy people in the town, Joshua says, "They're goblins, monstrous beings." there's of course the line about Grandpa Seth is in all our hearts, but you must banish him from your mind. You know, the "we'll be gone for a month. Can you take care of that business for me?" And this made me think about a couple of things. I'm sure both of these questions will come up again and again in Weird House Cinema, because anti-verisimilitude is one of the most common and interesting and enjoyable features in bad movies. But first of all, why is what we call verisimilitude a desirable characteristic in fiction to begin with? So verisimilitude is, of course, you know, the feeling of realism, the feeling of lifelikeness in a book or in a movie, you know, it seems true to life. Why is that desirable to begin with? And then the second thing is, what actually causes the feeling of verisimilitude in a film? As to why it's a desirable characteristic, I mean, there are a couple of answers. First of which is, verisimilitude is a mental lubricant, right? Like, it helps you stay immersed in the story and avoid unnecessary metacognition where you start remembering that you're sitting there watching a movie and thinking about it as a created piece of media. Anti-verisimilitude automatically and immediately causes that metacognition. Every time there's a line that thuds as unreal like that, you can't be in the story anymore because you're like, oh, wait a minute, I'm watching a movie.
One of the weird things about this, though, I don't know if you've had this experience, is that in a way, the experience of watching a film like this, like Troll 2, is akin to watching a production of a William Shakespeare play, you know? Because nobody in our immediate world speaks like a Shakespeare play. For that matter, you can point to other examples where this still holds up from contemporary authors. Like, nobody actually speaks like a David Mamet play, you know. But we're drawn into it. But on the other hand, it can throw you out of it at times if you stop to realize, oh, nobody talks like this. I don't talk like this. People around me don't talk like this. I don't eavesdrop conversations of this nature.
Well, this actually cuts ahead to the other question I wanted to answer. What causes something to feel realistic? Because I agree with you, and I'd actually go farther than you just did. It's not just Shakespeare or David Mamet. I would say flatly almost no movies have what could actually be called realistic dialogue, if you're going to be technical about it, because almost no movie has dialogue that sounds the way people really talk in life. And usually you wouldn't want a movie to sound that way because it would be boring. It would be really tedious and hard to understand and narratively inefficient. It would not move the plot along. And yet when we listen to characters in a movie talk to each other, there is a quality that we automatically look out for, and we intuitively think of this quality as realism or verisimilitude, but that's not exactly what it is, right? So what is that quality? And what is that quality that when it's violated, we feel like, oh, people don't talk like this?
Hmm.
I don't know the full answer to that question, but I think part of it has to do with a kind of flowing narrative logic where one idea or statement feels like it logically proceeds into the next one, even though that's not how people would actually have a conversation in real life usually. A lot of the dialogue in the movies that causes this feeling of anti-verisimilitude or feels very unreal has this quality of constantly stopping, or where the conversation is just jarring and you are repeatedly feeling this thud of an inappropriate maneuver in the conversation. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no. It makes sense. Like, you know, that it also drives home, I think, why sometimes the most memorable moment in a movie is when another character is telling a story.
Yeah.
Two examples come to mind from kind of related, but ultimately very different films. One, of course, is Quint in Jaws.
Oh, yeah.
But the other is Palpatine in Revenge of the Sith.
Mm.
There's a scene where he tells a story to Anakin. And both of those are tremendous scenes.
Best scene in the prequels, in my view.
Yeah, these are both like terrific scenes that have their own kind of inner reality. You could take either one outside of the rest of the film, and it would still make sense. It would still be entirely self-contained, and it is entirely narrative and structured in a way that we just completely consume it.
Can I learn to have this power? Not from a vegetarian.
And of course, Quint is eaten by a shark, so it's perfect as well.
This is also something we could come back to in future Weird House episodes, but I was thinking about the comparison between how verisimilitude is used in analyzing fiction versus verisimilitude in science, where the term has played an important role in the history of science and philosophy of science in like trying to come up with ideas about what makes a scientific theory a good one. The basic problem is, you know, we generally presume that the dominant theories in the sciences tend over time to advance toward increasing truthiness or verisimilitude. You know, they get a better and better description of life in the world as it really is. But, and this was a point discussed by the philosopher of science, Karl Popper, all scientific theories are, in the strictest understanding, false. They're never perfect explanations of reality. The understanding is that they're attempts to get closer and closer to accurately explaining and predicting the world. But you could ask questions like, what criteria would actually decide whether a theory is more truth-like or has more verisimilitude than another? For example, does it matter how much a theory explains, or does it matter more how accurately it explains what it does? You know, if a theory is like 90% accurate but explains a lot of things, is that better or worse than a theory that's 95% accurate but explains a lot less?
No, that's a good point. I mean, I guess to compare it to dialogue in a film, like as a viewer, you want that dialogue to tell you what's happening and what will happen. That's kind of what the dialogue's doing, right? Here's a dialogue scene that's about establishing the threat of the goblins or whatever. But on the other hand, you don't want it to be so blatantly explanatory. You know, it's a careful balance you have to strike.
Oh yeah, I mean that's actually one of my favorite types of bad dialogue in movies is the kind that is just obviously to fill the audience in about something. This is something the characters would never need to say to each other.
Oh, there's a tremendous scene of this to a certain extent in Troll 2, where the woman is transforming into the plant, has been transformed by the witch's potion. The goblins are eating her, and then you have the kid down there who's staring up, and he says, "They're eating her." And then they're going to eat me.
Yeah. Oh my God.
And there's a fly in his head the whole time. Yeah. It's also so weird and authentically 2020. But it's like, of course you're going to be eaten next. That's implied, but he says it too. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the wonderful things about this film.
I imagine this must have been a really buggy set because people get covered in green goop. And I imagine that goop was very sweet and sticky, whatever it was.
Yeah.
There must have been flies all over the place. There, you know, there's another great piece of dialogue like that in the very first scene where the mother sits down on Joshua's bed to explain to him that he must banish Grandpa Seth from his mind. She says, I think, She says, Grandpa Seth meant a lot to us. He meant a lot to you, to your sister, to your father, and to me, his daughter.
Oh, that's great.
Should we wrap up there?
I guess we should, yeah. Let's see, what else to point out here? I will say that I mentioned Night Killer, which also came out in 1990. It's a sleazier film.
I gotta say,
sexualized slasher film.
I tried to watch that one, and the good scenes are really funny, even like on the Troll 2 level. Like, there's a scene of a dance choreography rehearsal at the beginning that's just exquisite, but also that movie is gross. I would not recommend it at all.
So it's a deeper cut, not for everybody. It's not near as fun as Troll 2. Troll 2 is for the children. And I mean, well, don't take me to the bank on that, but I feel like it's more of a family
affair. Screen
it before
you show it to your children, but
yeah,
certainly more than Night Killer.
Yeah. Night Killer is not for most people, but it's out there as well. And you know, Fragasso has an entire, filmography that's worth exploring as well. We mentioned Best Worst Movie as a documentary worth checking out about, the making of Troll 2 and sort of the culture of its, acceptance, by cult film fans. I also want to point out that there's an excellent episode of CBC's Ideas, which is a radio show podcast. They did an episode on cult films titled The Cult Movie Canon, and they discuss like what makes a cult film, why do we keep coming back to them, and they mentioned several films, but there is a segment on Troll 2 that is notable.
Oh, cool. You've sent me that to check out before, and I apologize that I never got around to it. Now I feel bad. Well, I have to go back and listen to that now.
Yeah, they talk about Repo Man. They talk about The Last Dragon. It's a fun listen. They also interview some experts on bad movies and cult films.
Oh, wait, there's one more I have to mention before we quit, because it's one that's not really worth watching in full because it's pretty boring on its own, but it's a good one to sort of put on and catch a snip of here and there. And it's called Robo War. This was not directed by Claudio Fragasso. I think it was written by him and
directed by Bruno.
This one is a just blatant ripoff of Predator. It came out a year or two after Predator, and it has the guy who plays Blast Hard Cheese in Space Mutiny,
Red Brown.
Yes, he's playing the Arnold Schwarzenegger role, and the Predator in it is this cyborg. So if you watch the movie with the Google auto-generated subtitles on, it's on YouTube, and you get it to come up with the subtitles. The robot is sort of mumbling in all of its scenes where it's stalking people, and it keeps saying what YouTube thinks is greasy target center. And that phrase is in my head forever
greasy
now.
Greasy target center. That should have been the title.
Okay, that's it from me.
All right, we're going to go ahead and close out this episode of Weird House Cinema. But in the meantime, we'd love to hear from everybody. Do you think this is a wise use of our time? do you have problems with all of this? Let us know about that. But even more to the point, what other weird films should we consider for the future? Not only bad films, you know, not only B movies, but just films that have some element of weirdness to them. What would you like to hear us discuss on the show? Let us know. In the meantime, if you want to listen to episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, which again come out every Tuesday and Thursday, and maybe you want to listen to the occasional episode of Weird House Cinema on Fridays, well, you can find Stuff to Blow Your Mind wherever you get your podcast. That is the show. That is the feed. That is the podcast feed in which you find this show.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you'd like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it! Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at CedarPoint.com.